So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
man. You know, there's faster wrestlers, bigger wrestlers, stronger wrestlers, and younger wrestlers than me in the Rumble, but this is my state. Do you realize that Terry Funk is Texas bred and Texas fed, and I was born to Rumble?
You know, there's a lot of people that are talking about how I'm going into this Royal Rumble as sort of a marked man, that everybody's going to want to get me, but you know, that's nothing new for me. I've always been a marked man. And in this Royal Rumble, the way I see it, it's no turning back. I can't go back any further. I've already taken too many steps back. So in this Royal Rumble, there's going to be no stopping the excellence of execution. There's going to be one man standing at the end of this thing, and it's going to be me.
Most people see the Royal Rumble as a chance to get the shot at the World Wrestling Federation title. I see it as a chance to hurt a lot of people that I don't like, and even some that I do. It's gonna be a nice day.
See, this is where we got a problem. You TV guys always got the cameras where you don't belong. Well, the problem is I'm not talking to anybody until I throw 29 pieces of trash over the top rope and advance to WrestleMania to face the champ, so you can take your camera and stick it, son. That's it. Cut.
He's gonna win the Royal Rumble. Yeah, the British Bulldog. I've got a history in Royal Rumbles, and tonight I'm going to remake history by winning this night's Royal Rumble. Tonight, because I'm bizarre.
Brother Bellas on the back, sweet singers on the front, cruising down the freeway in the hot, hot sun. Suddenly, red blue lights flash us from behind. Loud voice booming, please step out onto the line.
Welcome to Review Away. It is John Pollock and Wei Ting with you. And Wei, we are back in our home away from home of Montreal, Quebec.
Yes, we are. We're here again.
What are we doing here?
We are here to cover the UFC 158 press conference. That is St. Pierre versus Nick Diaz. They just announced the fight, and we heard some very heated words between the two today.
Yes, well, first of all, Nick Diaz was here for this press conference, so that was a big positive right there.
Yeah.
I assume he was there.
I'm going out
on a limb here.
It's a little
fun. The press conference doesn't actually begun, everyone. It doesn't start till 10 a.m. on Wednesday, so.
It is actually.
But we've arrived.
Are you breaking kayfabe right now?
No, we're in Montreal, but we're about to go to the press conference.
Okay, it's early Montreal.
Very early.
It's minus 22 right
it
now.
It is cold.
Or so I hear.
Yeah.
I checked my phone. And Wednesday, it is minus 22, and we're about to start the press conference.
It is very, very cold. Not Alamo weather.
No, it's not Alamo weather.
Though Texas gets very cold.
Okay.
You know how I know that Texas got really cold? Because with Dallas, they would shoot it during the summer months, and they never shot during the winter, so it was always nice out. It would be too cold. A lot of their scenes were outside and stuff, so they never shot during the winter. So you never saw snow on Dallas.
So there's actual snow in places of Dallas.
Dallas gets cold winters.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep.
I guess, never mind.
It gets so cold that you have to get together in large groups of people, roughly 48,000 paid, into the Alamo Dome.
Not 60?
48,000 was how many people paid.
Oh, I see.
That show, let's just get right into it. A very impressive stat, but, you know, since that time, a lot of people have talked about that. This was such a downtime in WWF. How did they get such a big house? And the key was the most expensive tickets were $175 for that show. The second most expensive tickets, what do you think they cost? There were four price points.
Okay, I'm going to guess $100.
$18.
Really?
All the way down to $10 tickets. So the majority of these people, this was a $480,000 gate for a 60,000 person attended show.
So who are these suckers that paid $175?
Pete Lothario.
Yes, right. but I wonder how that division would be. I mean, you go from 175, I guess the ringside, and I'm assuming the floors are all 175?
I would guess only a few rows would be. Like, it was just an incredibly discounted show.
It would really suck to be the last row of $175 tickets.
Yeah.
You know?
The guy behind you paid 18?
Yeah. I'd be pissed.
I would stand up and block his view with a sign all night long. Yeah. You are not going to enjoy this rumble at my expense.
Well, it is impressive to brag about that you managed to draw that many people and made
the full. Definitely.
Was it worth their while, you think, to do this?
I mean, I think so. I mean, $480,000 is still $480,000, and looked impressive. And I think you had the match that was going to draw people in San Antonio. Shawn Michaels, after losing the title, getting the rematch for that title in his hometown, you at least had that hook. And I think the inclusion of the AAA talent was also a draw to people in that part of the country.
You honestly think so?
Judging
by the reaction of that match, I don't think any of those people came to see them.
Well, it wasn't exactly a lively crowd, but I mean, such is the case with a lot of stadium shows where I think...
this, though, was something else.
It was pretty dead. It sounded pretty
dead. Completely
dead. So this was obviously a time when the WWF, they were certainly down in the shithouse, so to speak, at this point. WCW kicking their ass in every aspect of business at this point. So a low point for the company, but also the kickoff to a year that was a real momentum builder for the WWF in 97.
When would you say that actually changed and they really, would you say that this was a part of the Attitude Era, or was it just the pre-beginnings of it?
I think this was, the early inception of what would mature into the Attitude Era, so to speak. And I think that for the company, I think if you were to fast forward to the summer of 97, I think that's when you could see the quality of the product really turning around. And then the actual numbers would start to reflect that quality in the spring of 98.
How raunchy was Raw at this time? Because there's only one moment in this broadcast that really kind of made me think that it was, and that was the Goldust angle, where Lawler has this interview with Goldust and says the word queer.
Censored, though, on this broadcast.
On the broadcast, yes.
Well, yes. That Goldust character from the onset was always a character that got a lot of criticism from people outside of pro wrestling, and people were very offended by this effeminate male.
Mm-hmm.
This man is gay.
I don't know if they're offended by that or just maybe just the idea that there would be a character so sexualized on a, otherwise, I guess, pretty family-friendly product.
Well, certainly those changes were becoming evident, I would say, in 96, mid to late 96.
Mm-hmm.
You're always going to have your outliers of angles that, really push the bounds of good taste. I mean, one that comes to mind was in the summer of 96 was when Jake Roberts had his feud with Jerry Lawler, where it was all about him being an alcoholic and Lawler pouring booze down his throat. I mean, good taste is at times hard to come by in professional wrestling. But in 97, certainly the dial was turned up when it came to that aspect. And by late 97, I think you saw the big turn for the company, where it did leave a number of people, both critics and even people working in the company, a little uneasy with the edge that the product was taking at that point.
Right.
So the 97 Rumble from the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, Texas, and a very interesting show in hindsight here. This was coming off Sid's WWF title win at the Survivor Series the prior November at Madison Square Garden, a rare review way that we have reviewed that you were not here for during your worldwide tour a while back when Arda stepped in.
That is right. That is right, yes.
Myself and Arda reviewed that show. Mm-hmm. And Sid, a babyface at Madison Square Garden. They loved him, and they hated the babyface Shawn Michaels.
Now, okay, and how did they treat that, and how did they follow up from that?
I mean, they still presented Sid as a heel, but he was certainly becoming kind of that cool heel to a lot of people. You were kind of pushing Bret Hart as this... he had made the comeback at that same Survivor Series show and then got the match with Sid and started the whole gimmick of, complaining and getting screwed. And a number of people took to Sid at this point.
So not in this crowd, though.
No. He was the hated villain in San Antonio, Texas. But the show opened up with an opening video with Shawn Michaels discussing his journey to win the title and then losing it to Sid, where the dream was shattered. And man, the overbearing voiceover here with such lines as, "That night, the boy toy grew up because he put his own selfishness aside to help Jose Lothario, who was hit with a camera in the chest."
No.
They were teasing, you know, heart pain and chest pains for Jose Lothario. Maybe he was going to die.
His cameras are heavy.
They are very heavy. And tonight is about justice, redemption, and saying that Shawn Michaels, his innocence is gone, and he returns to San Antonio a man.
He's the
boy,
man.
Was this more heavy-handed than you could possibly hit me over the head with.
He's the man toy.
Tonight was about justice.
Sid Justice.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, I wonder if that was intentional or not in this definitely. Voiceover. But boy, he's returning a man, Way. His innocence lost. He's a man with a beard.
How often has the WWE run San Antonio with Shawn headlining around this time?
I mean, this was the first time they really put the whole heavy push onto Shawn Michaels. I remember they did that Survivor Series we reviewed a few years ago. It was in 94. It was in San Antonio. But Michaels was a heel. Right. He was never really pushed with that San Antonio connection. But this was the pay-per-view.
So this really was like his first homecoming as top baby.
Yeah, where it was really hit hard that he's, you know, the hometown hero coming home. So we mentioned the crowd here announced at over 60,000. And then we had numerous international announcers here, Way. Not only did we have the tandem of Vince McMahon, Jim Ross, and Jerry Lawler, but then the Spanish crew of Arturo Rivera, Hugo Savinovich, and Carlos Cabrera, but then Ramon and Jacques Rougeau Sr. on the international broadcast for the French listeners.
I wonder who the French announcers are today for the WWE.
Patrick Côté and...
No, I don't think so.
Pat LaPrade could be doing French commentary.
He certainly could.
He'd be very well versed.
I would think so.
We were just out with Pat last night.
Yes, we were. Oh, you mean, yes, we were.
Tuesday night, we were out with our good buddy, Pat LaPrade, whose book is coming out in a few weeks.
Electric Avenue. Good times.
It is. Then we go to our opening matchup.
No, here. I mean it, though. I'd like to know who the French announcers are these days.
I have no idea.
Well, I'm sure somebody listening out there in Quebec.
You should have asked Pat last night, because that's how... He would watch.
You know what? We will ask Pat last night.
Let's go back in time and ask Pat on when we see him. When we did see him in the past future.
Last night, yes.
Opening match, Hunter Hearst Helmsley, as he was referred to at the time, not Triple H. I wonder when that decision came.
But
so let's shorten this guy's name.
They did announce him as Triple H in the, I guess one of the announcers did, or in the recap, they did call him Triple H.
It's such a stupid name. Like, I've always hated his name. Like, this is a dumb, dumb name.
No, well, it's a nickname. It started off as a nickname. I mean, like, Arn Anderson, Double A. Is that odd?
He was never really billed as just Double A. Like, everything was Double A. This is like, everything is Triple H. Triple H. And you just say it enough times that you don't think twice about it. But
it's silly when the guy's actual name in print is Triple H. Like, his first name is Triple.
Triple. I'd love to see one. I guarantee you he's done non-wrestling interviews.
Yeah.
What's going on, Triple?
Yeah. It's like we had a producer here. I probably said this before on the podcast, but we did an interview with Samoa Joe. Mouth did an interview with Samoa Joe. And our producer, who no longer works with us, but he's a great producer, but obviously it comes from a sports background, knows very
out
little,
of his world here.
Little about professional wrestling. Welcome, Samoa. Right over here, Samoa. Have a seat. The world of wrestling is just so awkward for when you try to bring bring it into everyday life.
I always hate when I'm like, if I'm setting up an interview or going to interview someone who it's like they only go by that gimmick name, like a Raven, for instance. It's like, I feel stupid calling this guy Scott. Like, I know what your real name is, but at the same time, I sound even more stupid.
Raven's not that bad. Raven's a...
Hey, Raven?
People have actual... Like, Raven Simone. Like, That's So Raven, the Cosby
girl? I don't see the connection, but okay. Sure.
Raven's a real enough sounding name, okay? But maybe Balls. Balls Mahoney.
How's it going, Balls?
Yeah, that'd be odd.
Yeah, a little odd. So opening match here, Hunter Hearst Helmsley with his I do not remember this gimmick at all, where Mr. Hughes was briefly paired with Triple H as his butler. This was shortly before first Hunter, he would always have a new woman that would come out with him every time out, and that actually led to Sable's introduction when they brought her in. And then I guess this was a brief time they put Mr. Hughes with him right before they found China.
Right.
And I remember where it was just so obvious that they were just trying to find something that would click with this guy. And when they brought out China, I was like, man, they are just completely lost here. And none of these people are going to work. But yeah. China turned out to work.
China worked out pretty well.
Yep. Until she didn't work out any longer.
Yeah.
Painful memories for Wei Tin. Defending the title against Goldust, accompanied by Marlena for the Intercontinental title, with Helmsley defending the title.
Now, this feud was over at Marlena, was it not?
Yes. Hunter wanted her, and Goldust was like, hey, that's my woman.
And that's when we got the interview with Jerry Lawler and Goldust on Raw, where they basically said, you know, Goldust has always been a very flamboyant character, but he's never completely admitted to being queer.
Queer,
which they bleeped out. And then,
and only in professional wrestling does a guy telling people, no, in fact, I am not a homosexual, is justified babyface turn.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Thank God. Now we can cheer for this guy because he's not one of those weird queers.
That was the
subtext here.
Okay, yeah, sure. But I wouldn't say that's just in pro wrestling. I'd say that's in the majority of circles in our society.
I don't know about that.
Maybe more so in pro wrestling. Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, come on. If this
You're telling me if a musician that kind of teased a homosexuality finally announces that he's straight, I'm getting married to a woman, suddenly he's going to be embraced?
Hold on.
I don't think the general public really scorns someone for being...
Scorn's not the right word, but I mean, it happens all the time in media where actors are presumed gay and then they come out to the media and say, I'm actually not gay. And I don't know if scorn is the right word for it, but I mean, you know, people do this type of thing all the time where they just deny their homosexuality or the assumption.
That is one of the theories with Monte Teo, the football player.
Oh, really?
Is that one outlet was talking about how these kinds of stories, or at least this construction, is consistent with a lot of people that have, you know, whether it be high profile, you know, jobs or whatnot, construct these false realities to present a heterosexual lifestyle. Not saying that Monte Teo is gay, but it would at least
be nothing wrong if he was.
I'm not
actually there is something wrong because he lied. He made up this lie. That's what would be wrong.
Well, presumably he was either the victim of some elaborate hoax or he was willfully going along with some hoax that has what a strange story.
Yeah, I would figure if you're just trying to. I don't know, stay in the closet. There are probably easier ways of just doing that.
If this Monte Teo thing happened in like 96, Goldust could have been easily the Monte Teo of pro wrestling. They could have done something. You'd have to get rid of Marlena somehow. Or he tells Jerry Lawler, no, I'm not queer. In fact, I have a wife and child, but we never see them. Ever.
We met on...
And it turns out Goldust is homosexual.
They met on AOL. It was Facebook at the time.
Keyword superstars.
Uh-huh.
All right. So that was the backdrop for this matchup. And Goldust attacks him here in the aisle during the entrance. And Goldust is the aggressor at the start of the match on the floor. Drops the ring steps onto Hunter. This was not grounds for a DQ, which the announcers called attention to.
This was
like a street fight.
This was a big, big bump. I mean, just basically dropping.
He lifted the steps and dropped it onto, like, Hunter's knee.
Like in a video game.
Yeah, this was very violent. McMahon gives us an update here on George and Adam, who they did these horrible comedy skits with.
On the free-for-all.
Yeah, they were did you watch the free-for-all?
No.
Neither did I. Security has thrown them out of the building, and I always remember hating these two. And I believe the guy Adam is still an editor now with the WWF.
Right, he's the guy that Sean talked about.
A redheaded kid, yeah. George, I cannot say where his whereabouts have led him to in pro wrestling, the post-life. But these two would come back at the Slammy Awards, where their big spot was peeing their pants during The Undertaker's entrance on stage. So,
okay.
Anyway, Hunter hits an axe handle off the top to the floor, despite his bad knee. Then runs his knee and misses going into the guardrail, and Goldust attacks his left knee, dropping the steps on them yet again. Goldust applies a figure four, continues using the ropes for leverage. Goldust was like working as a heel in this match.
He was just aggressive. I wouldn't say he was a heel.
I guess when you're fighting on behalf of a woman's honor, the rules are out the window.
Yeah, he was just
can grab the ropes and not
just being aggressive. I mean, he was really pissed off.
Goldust spills to the floor, and then we cut to a picture-in-picture here with Todd Pettengill in the crowd with none other than country music sensation Colin Ray.
Forget this match. This is Colin
Ray. God damn, this is long. Todd.
I've never heard of this man.
Nor have I.
Not really.
I wish I didn't hear from him on this show where he even sang.
Yeah, Todd Pettengill asked him for a few bars, and I don't know how this man has a career in music. It sucked.
Colin Ray. Do you want to find out what Colin Ray is up to?
Sure. Colin Ray.
I wonder if he is still active.
Well, 16 years is a long time.
Oh, Colin Ray. That's Ray with an E.
And what is he doing? Oh, he's gaining weight.
Oh, yeah. Jesus. He's from Arkansas. What was he doing in San Antonio that night? What's he...
Well, people can leave Arkansas just because you're from a place doesn't mean you have to stay in a place.
Well, I guess so.
So what's he doing today?
An American country music singer known professionally as Colin Ray. His real name is Floyd Elliott Ray with a W at the front.
Okay.
He made his debut on the American country music
I don't need
scene.
To know his whole life. I just want to know what he's up to right
His
now.
Most recent album, Never Going Back, was released on April 28, 2009. Maybe that was his retirement because he's never going back. Is there anything here about the Rumble? Social activism? No. No mention about the Royal Rumble.
Well, great. Thank you. Thank you for that update on Colin Ray.
Now you know, Way.
Yeah.
He had an album called The Walls Came Down. It's too bad him and Chris Jericho didn't intersect in the WWF.
Yeah.
They could have had, that could have been his entrance.
Yeah.
Country Chris Jericho.
Okay. Another lifetime.
Yeah. Anyway, Vince McMahon brings up the fact that these two could be in the Rumble tonight. And then Goldust misses a top rope elbow drop. Mr. Hughes tosses the title in, and Hunter grabs it. And then the referee is distracted as Hunter forces himself onto Marlena and makes out with her. And Goldust attacks him with a belt shot, but Mr. Hughes then pulls Hunter to the floor. Goldust takes a lit cigar from Marlena and puts it out in Mr. Hughes' neck.
Yeah, ouch.
Jesus Christ. And then Hunter attacks him from behind as he's distracted with Hughes, hits the pedigree and pins Goldust 16 minutes and 50 seconds. And I wrote down here, Marlena is extremely skinny, like unhealthy skinny.
Okay.
She looked to be 90 pounds here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I thought this was a pretty weak match.
Long match.
I thought both these guys are pretty, you know, much more capable of having a better match than this. Excuse me. I just didn't think it really developed much momentum, didn't really develop much of a flow. I thought the finish was overbooked. I did notice, however, while watching these things, it's fun to watch, you know, to see how far and how much these people have changed, because a lot of these people on this card are still active today.
Yep.
And of course, Triple H being perhaps the most high-profile guy, and it's just impressive to see the change in his body over the years.
What are you talking about?
Some changes, yes. But not only that, but just in his working style. Here, at this point in his career, he's much more willing to sell, much more willing to take big bumps. He actually reminded me a lot of, like, Dolph Ziggler now, just really bumping hard to get noticed.
Yeah, it certainly was. And this was actually in the wake of that whole Madison Square Garden incident, which happened in early 96 or spring of 96.
Okay.
So Hunter was not in the best spot at this point in early 97, even with they did put the IC title on him towards the end of the year, but still someone that was trying to really catch on. And because to me, like, the whole blue blood gimmick he had, it was very, it certainly had a certain limit to it. And he really wasn't over at this point, I would say, to the term, to, you know, obviously where he would eventually get to in 97, actually, which would be a big year for him. They show a taped interview with Bret Hart, who talks about being a marked man in the Rumble, and there will be no stopping him, and he will win. Then Mankind is in the boiler room, sees the Rumble as a chance to hurt a lot of people that he does not like.
These are just like what they, you know, used to do in the earlier Rumbles and earlier pay-per-views, where everybody would cut their quick promos in front of the same backdrop. And
but this one, they took them into different settings.
Oh, their own natural environments.
Yes.
Bret, whose natural environment is a locker room, and Mankind's, whose is a boiler room.
That's still the best compliment that I think we got for Survival of the Hitman, was where it was like, well, I really liked how they shot all these people in...
Oh, you mean Lance Storm?
Oh, yeah, it was Lance. It was Lance Storm who said this about, you know, they shot Bret at his home, where it made the most sense. Keith was kind of in a study with books in the back, and then you had Bruce in this dingy hotel, and it was like, on paper, like, yeah, this makes a lot of sense, this little...
No. That was the criticism about Bruce. It's just he was in... You know,
I don't know if he was criticizing that, that each setting kind of fit the person.
I think he said this was on one of the Figure Four podcasts that Lance was on.
I can't remember it exactly.
No,
he was saying
they all made sense except for Bruce.
Oh, except for Bruce.
Because Bruce was just in some.
Yeah.
Some
and then, right. And Lance was in a gym and stuff. And yeah, in hindsight, I'm like, yeah, these kind of all mostly did make sense and completely by accident.
Oh, but he's absolutely right, though. Like, Bruce, we shot because we really had no other place, and the hotel room is where he met us, and it was the quietest place. Originally, I would have liked to have shot him in a bar.
Well, we did meet him in a bar
Which would have fit.
That was my highlight of that trip, was having beers with Bruce, Keith, and Ross.
Yes, we did.
We did.
But I'm just saying, in terms of picking natural habitats for these people, a bar would have sufficed for Bruce Hart.
Was that still, would you say that final week before that documentary aired was your most challenging week? Because I remember you doing like overnights here, editing that with Steve.
George Barbosa.
I think Steve Duncan did like something ridiculous, like 38 straight hours.
Yeah. Well, he did all our graphics and color correcting, so that took a long time. But, it was we really rushed to get that documentary out before that week, before the Mania. And it was fun to do. I mean, you know, when you're working and doing these things, you kind of look forward to having important projects like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so that was our segue off of Bret Hart and Mankind cutting promos for the Rumble.
Yeah.
And then the Nation of Domination come out with their gigantic entourage at the time, which included Clarence Mason, I believe D'Lo Brown was in there, PG-13, a woman.
Was that the name of the rap group?
They didn't call them PG-13 in the Nation, but that's who they were in Memphis for USWA.
Oh, and they're actual workers.
Oh, yeah. One of them was Bill Dundee's son, Jamie Dundee.
And they happened to rap?
Yeah, they were the rappers here.
Right.
And they had this old man in there. Really weird, eclectic group, this Nation of Domination.
Mm-hmm.
And Crush, of course. Can't have a nation. Of Domination without Crush.
Nope.
Yep.
A Hawaiian.
Yes. Then we got a video on the feud between Farouk and Ahmed, featuring Ahmed trying to get the chant of, "Yo, go on.
I had no idea what he was saying until the fifth time he chanted this.
It's amazing. There's some times where people will talk about, you know, criticisms of a performer, and then you go back, and it never lives up to the criticisms. But Ahmed Johnson was truly an incoherent promo.
He could be the Aces and Eights leader.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, sounds like Bane.
Ahmed Johnson. And, some of his outfits here at the time, he runs in with these spandex pants and a 2x4.
Yep.
They recap his huge rise in 1996, winning the Intercontinental title, and then the ominous voiceover. It almost came to a tragic end when he was the victim of a turf war.
Yeah.
Made it sound like...
He got caught in crossfire.
Yeah. Jeez, they really weren't playing off of like real life gang violence here at all.
Mm.
Here are two black men involved in a turf war.
What was it?
Over the Intercontinental title.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kicked in the kidney by Farouk and nearly died.
Yeah.
Nearly died.
And I remember this angle. This was a heavy angle at the time, and they showed the footage of, you know, an actual surgery.
You know, they don't often actually play with death. You know, like they don't announce that, oh shit, this guy almost died, and now he's coming back from death. Like only if it's you know, real. Like Jerry Lawler, for instance. But I mean, in a wrestling angle, I think even they thought it was a bit taboo.
I was a bit desensitized to this because, as I've mentioned, I'm really in the Sons of Anarchy kick right now.
Okay.
Where it's like, it's just ridiculous. Like, I watch like 5 episodes a day now of this show. I'm just trying to blitz through the entire series.
Don't spoil it, though.
I won't. But it's just something happens to the group. It's just like, it's not even discussed. It's like, okay, we've got to kill somebody now. That's how we retaliate. Mm-hmm. We murder people. So watching this video, I was like, well, Ahmed should kill Farouk. He should bomb his car like Chips in season 2.
Oh, now I'm not going to watch it.
Well, you don't know what happens to Chips.
I don't know who Chips is.
Anyway, there was a Pearl River plunge on a car during this video, which was akin to a car bomb in World Wrestling Federation.
A car bomb?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a power bomb.
Pearl River
car
bomb.
Yeah. There you go.
Ahmed comes out with this flashing strobe light. I nearly fell over in my chair from a seizure because of this light. They it was like glaring in my head, and then they zoom in on it. Who made this call? Kevin Dunn almost killed me.
Maybe he's maybe Ahmed's like a raver, like a 90s raver.
I don't think he was. His character didn't seem like a raver.
You don't know that?
I don't know. He's all taped up here. Wore a lot of gear on his legs.
What are you suggesting?
I'm not suggesting anything. Oh. I'm stating the obvious. He wears his trunks, and then he has knee pads, and he's got thigh pads, and he's got shit all over himself, and a weightlifting belt that reads Ahmed on the back. I wonder if there's a few of those left in the WWF storage.
Ahmed
weightlifting belts for kids.
I don't know. I would love to own one.
Yeah. So we get the long-awaited grudge match between Farouk and Ahmed Johnson. And Johnson attacks him with punches and stomps in the corner, runs him into the post, and Farouk has a belt and gets dropped with a shoulder block. Johnson then whips him with a belt, and Farouk throws one of his guys into Ahmed on the floor. Ahmed clotheslines him, and then Farouk is able to scoop slam Ahmed kidney first onto a chair that he set up on the floor, and he goes after the kidney of Ahmed Johnson. Mm-hmm. Not too many matches where they isolate a body part that is the kidney, a vital organ.
Yeah, well, a lot of times they would attack the ribs, I guess, and they would call it the kidney.
Yeah. Johnson lifts him up back in the ring, shoulders first, and hits the electric chair.
But you're right. They never isolate, the stomach or the spleen.
Yeah.
I guess the spleen, maybe.
It's a good strategy.
But, you don't attack the lung.
The lung. Farouk climbs to the top, jumps into a power slam. Then Johnson jumps, takes a spine buster, but he pops up, gives his own spine buster, and then Crush runs in, gets sent to the floor, more members of the Nation run in, and a disqualification is called at 8:45. Shitty finish to a match that people, they had built this up for months.
No, I didn't think this was a good match either.
No. Not a great match. Crowd was into Ahmed at certain parts of the match, and I think you had a combination of not a really great crowd and also just a stadium where whatever noise was made really goes up. And
sure.
But I'm not defending this crowd. They were not very great throughout this show.
But this match wasn't very great.
No,
that's true. They didn't really have many matches to get excited about.
So after the match, he tosses one of PG-13 over the top rope to the floor, took great care of him as he just sent him over, tripped on the top rope, and fell. Thankfully, he was caught. Then another guy gets hit from behind as Farouk runs to the back. And anyway, this dude is just backpedaling away from Ahmed. They end up in front of the French announce desk, and Ahmed sets up the steps, gets on the steps with this member of the Nation, and hits a Pearl River plunge in midair onto the French announce table. And by Ahmed's standards, at least hit this as well as could be expected. If I was this worker, no way is Ahmed giving me this spot onto a table. I thought he would have killed me. Yeah. Ahmed was not the safest guy.
He really wasn't. No.
Reckless.
He fell onto off of the steps after.
He did stumble and fall onto the guy, but thankfully the guy looked to take a reasonably safe bump through the French announce table.
Mm-hmm.
And they left the monitor on there, too.
Yeah.
It's like, Jesus, this is you're really pushing your luck here with Ahmed Johnson. So there you go. Feud continues between The Nation and Ahmed Johnson. So they say that afterwards that the first match, the Rumble here, in case you were thinking of getting any payoffs, right after the Goldust Triple H match, they announce, well, this personal issue is going to continue. And then after this match, Ross announces, the war has begun between these two. So you're not getting any finality on this Rumble. Mm. They show Terry Funk in the locker room and calls Texas his state, and he was born to rumble. This was Terry Funk, a brief period for Terry Funk in the WWF.
Mm-hmm.
And then Todd Pettengill is with the Nation of Domination. I counted 8 of them here. And Farouk yells at 2 members, including a woman, for abandoning him out there, and says he will get Ahmed in the Rumble, and refers to Ahmed as Uncle Tom.
Yeah.
So pushing the race button here. Way was disgusted by this.
Oh, racism.
Pervasive
Jesus.
Use.
Why? I thought it was awesome how he yells at this woman.
Yeah. Abandoned me.
You abandoned me. You should have been out there fighting with me.
It was good to...
This
good
woman
line.
And this skinny man. I thought that was great.
Next up, we had Vader against The Undertaker. Jim Cornette not in the corner of Vader. And Taker, they announce, giving up 130 pounds, according to Jim Ross, and calls this a gut check for Vader.
Hold on a second. 130 pounds?
That's how much Taker was giving up.
They announced Taker as like 300-something pounds.
So that means they were announcing Vader at over 450.
Okay.
Not look over 450.
All right, 450.
He's a big man. Not that big a man. The Undertaker, sporting his little Wayne tear under his right eye.
What?
He had the tear painted on his under his eye.
I didn't see that.
You didn't see this?
No. I believe you.
Okay.
Well, that means he's probably murdered somebody.
Or he was raped in prison.
Is that what that means?
That the tear has many different meanings.
Okay.
No one's 100%
sure.
Why
would somebody get a tattoo? Oh, you mean somebody tattooed it onto him?
Well, we're assuming this was a tattoo the Undertaker had. It disappeared years later. Months later.
All right.
But there you go. Maybe that was the Undertaker. The dead man. He's killed people. The Undertaker teardrop. I don't know why this isn't more of a thing in wrestling folklore. The Undertaker tear that's painted on. Uh-huh. No, there's nothing there to show. Anyway, Taker hits an axe handle from behind to the floor onto Vader. Vader hits a neck breaker on the top rope. Taker has a jumping leg drop, a scoop slam. Jim Ross says he has never seen anyone deliver a leg drop quite like The Undertaker. What a dig this was.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Hulk Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
This was actually, I think, a week after the very first WCW or NWO sold out pay-per-view. So the Rumble was coming off of one of the worst pay-per-views in history for fans. Vader shakes the ropes during the old school spot, which I guess this was just a regular school at the time.
Yes.
Class was in session here.
That is correct. What is the tactical idea behind this rope walk? Why? What advantage does it give him to walk on a shaky rope?
Well, he's adding more leverage with the height.
Oh, then why don't you?
And then he's hitting the big hammer fist with a greater height.
Yeah, why don't you just jump off the turnbuckle? Why do you have to walk along this unbalanced rope?
Because he wants to prolong the. I don't know. I don't know the psychological breakdown. Maybe Henry Gracie could do a breakdown. Get out of just, you know, the ground game and explain to us a bit about the old school.
Okay. You know, I would buy any type of explanation. Like, I buy the people's elbow. He's gaining momentum as he's jumping and running.
We need to have, like, a physicist on the podcast to break down wrestling holds.
Yes, we do.
Actually, that'd be a very funny segment to do on camera.
It'd be knowledgeable.
Someone to actually break down the legitimate damage done with pro wrestling holds.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they cut to a fan. Once again, I guess they got bored of this match. We go to a fan in the crowd. Summer Bishop, who is with Todd Pettengill, saved all of her money since last summer, follows Shawn Michaels everywhere, and raises money through babysitting to attend the 97 Royal Rumble.
You mean plane tickets and everything?
I don't know, because if
from
these
Alaska?
Were like $14 tickets, I mean, is this really a big feat? This was like a Friday night.
I would assume it was one of the expensive ones. They interviewed her.
Did they say where she was from?
Alaska, I thought.
Oh, I missed it. Oh, you're right. They did say Alaska. That's not a cheap plane ride.
That's an expensive flight.
If you're flying from Alaska into the U.S., is that considered like would you need your passport?
Because
you're flying within the country.
I don't know. I would assume that you wouldn't.
Yeah, I would guess
unless
not.
You're stopping over.
If we have some Alaskan listeners, mm-hmm. maybe they can let us know what the protocol is to travel outside of Alaska.
Sure. I don't really care that much.
Okay, then don't tell us.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have any listeners in Alaska. Vader hits a power bomb, gets a two count. Taker sits up, hits a flying clothesline, and then hits the old school. So he does get the move in. Then Paul Bearer comes down. This was after he had turned on The Undertaker at SummerSlam the prior year. Taker chokeslams Vader, clotheslines him to the floor, and then he heads to the floor, punches Paul Bearer, throws him into the ring, and grabs him by the throat. Vader comes from behind, but Taker catches him with a clothesline. Then they fight by the French desk, which has already been replaced with a new table. And Taker, basically doing his own poetry in motion, jumps off the steps and misses Vader hitting the barricade. I think this was the influence behind Jeff Hardy deciding I could hurt myself a lot worse doing something similar to this. And as Vader gets out of the way, Paul Bearer comes off the apron, attacks The Undertaker with the urn, and Vader hits the Vader bomb for the win at 13 minutes and 20 seconds. And Vader and Paul Bearer leave together, and Taker gets up. He's pissed at the poor officiating, chokeslams Jack Doan, then destroys the timekeeper's table, throws a chair at the post, and then yells at Vince McMahon, "The Undertaker ain't taking shit no more."
Yeah, he's going to leave to WCW maybe.
Yeah, the jump.
They had announced that Jack Doan was also attacked by The Undertaker in a prior matchup.
Oh, so they were building up. Maybe Jack Doan was going to go after the streak before they changed plans. Taker was not originally earmarked for the title picture at WrestleMania that year. They were going in the direction of Shawn Michaels' Bret Hart rematch.
Right.
And then someone lost a facial expression and they had to make alternate plans.
That's right. Jack Jones still there, right?
He is still there.
That is incredible.
He is one of the Iron Men.
Mm-hmm. As far as the match goes, I thought, so far this show has been
underwhelming show.
0 for 3 right now.
Steve Austin's in the back, not talking to anyone until he wins the Rumble, and tells the person to take their camera and stick it.
Yep. Great. To the point.
Yep.
I like it. Even this early on, and you'll see this throughout the Rumble too, but they were hinting at a babyface turn with Steve Austin.
Oh, certainly there was momentum growing behind the Austin character. That's kind of this... this idea was that, the Bret-Austin match, it was one guy was this solid babyface, the other was the solid heel going in. And realistically, if you were watching the TV at the time, you could sense that tide turning. I mean, it was evident with Bret this early on that, the tides were changing for their each individual character. Then my favorite interview, the British Bulldog arriving at the arena wearing full 1997 pro wrestler attire right down to the fanny pack, yells at the fans who are cheering the entrances of these wrestlers, says, "I am going to win the Rumble because I'm Bizarre." I had to rewind this to make sure I heard this right. "I'm going to win because I'm Bizarre."
What does that mean?
I have no idea. I took it to mean possibly intoxicated.
Yeah. I'm Bizarre.
If ever there was a retake moment, that was probably it. But for history's sake, glad this remained in there.
Yeah, I'm Bizarre. I don't know. I mean, if you're Gold Dust, somehow that would give you an advantage. But Bulldog's far from Bizarre.
Yeah, the Bizarre one, Davey Boy Smith.
Yeah.
Then we went to a 6-man tag. The WWF, they had this working arrangement with the AAA organization out of Mexico at the time. And I think this was a response to the WCW Cruiserweight division. And also, they were in a border state here in Texas where hopefully the luchadors could be a bit of an ass and helpful to them on this card. And this could be interesting because TNA and AAA also have a loose agreement right now. Jeff Jarrett's down in AAA. That it wouldn't surprise me if some AAA talent is used when they run lockdown at the Alamo Dome in March.
Why not? It was so successful here.
I sense some sarcasm.
Yeah.
We had Fuerza Guerrero, Heavy Metal, Jerry Estrada, teaming up to take on Hector Garza, Perro Aguayo, and Canek.
Canek.
Who holds a win over Luthez, as was brought up. Mm-hmm. And your referee was Pepe Casas, and I cite a big conflict of interest as Pepe Casas, the father of Heavy Metal, and Negro Casas.
Well, that's not fair.
So you can't have your son here in a match calling this down the middle.
Hmm.
So Garza, who people were very, very high on at this point, and he would actually end up in WCW shortly thereafter, but someone that, unfortunately, his biggest career break was going to come in TNA, where he was going to be one of their solid baby faces they pushed around 2005 and then crossed the border with some juice and could not return for a number of years. That was his chance at a big break and really...
Why would he cross the border for that? You can get plenty of that on the other side.
Do your juice in Mexico and then don't bring it across the border.
And get your juice here.
Man, that's an instance of steroids hurting a guy's career.
Yeah, unfortunate. Yeah.
Come on, guys. Anyway, Garza and Heavy Metal start off. This was hilarious because this was pretty much Vince McMahon just sat back and, all right, Jim.
I give up.
You take it. What a maneuver. Jim Ross, who thankfully did his research here. Estrada took this big back body drop to the floor.
And that's amazing because Vince is the guy who signs their paycheck, you would think.
The best was when it was Vince, I think, actually tried at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then he was like, we got Heavy Metal in there. And no, he said, that's Jerry Estrada. And Jim Ross had to correct him. Well, Vince, that's actually Heavy Metal.
He's quiet. After
fuck
that.
This. Yeah. These Mexicans. Estrada took this big back body drop to the floor by Aguayo. Guerrero comes in and misses a dive off the top to Canek, and Canek then hits a top rope cross body. Garza and Heavy Metal come in, and they pick up the speed here without doing too much, and Canek then connected with a series of drop kicks to Estrada. Canek and then Garza, they attack the leg of Heavy Metal. Garza, really the big spot of this match, he hit this corkscrew dive off the turnbuckle to the floor onto Estrada, and then the finish came as Aguayo went to the top rope, went for the double stomp to Heavy Metal, slipping off of him, to which Jim Ross says, I don't think he got all of that, and Aguayo covered him for the three count at 10:57. Mm-hmm. This match fell pretty flat to the crowd, and not the best showcase of the AAA luchadors, and also picking, you know, Aguayo, you know, a legend in Mexico, but really didn't resonate with this crowd. And to me, if you wanted to win over a crowd, you know, showcase the high flying. And, you know, with all due respect to Perro Aguayo and Canek, not their forte by 1997.
Yeah. And it got to the point where I almost felt bad for these guys because this audience was reacting to so little. And, you know, throughout the match, they would do all these spots, and then they'd try to motion to the crowd to get some type of reaction. And maybe it could have been, you know, the how big the stadium was, maybe the sound not reaching the people, but at least to the TV cameras and to the sound, you couldn't hear anything. I'd never seen a match
also,
see such little reaction.
This went 11 minutes. It went, I thought, too long, and the crowd just sitting on their hands really emphasized how long it went. So, yeah, I guess you're saying 0 for 4.
0 for 4.
Wow. Way. A 0 out of 10 so far on the show, I think, for him. The Finkel then announces the crowd at 60,477. And then we go to the Royal Rumble match, not ending the show. And we'll get Wave's thoughts on this afterwards, if it was the right call or not. And intervals were...
Well, yeah, I'd say it was the right call.
Yeah, I think so.
Absolutely.
Too.
San Antonio, Shawn Michaels.
I agree. The intervals every 90 seconds instead of 2 minutes. And it starts off with Crush and Ahmed Johnson. And they start off, and the sign in the crowd, someone actually made a sign that read WWF, an acrostic poem.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Wild, wacky, fun.
Oh, there's no way they'll confiscate this.
Wild, wacky, fun.
Wild, wacky, fun.
I'm surprised they didn't edit this out there in when they had to go back and erase. I guess because they didn't have the Scratch logo, no. They could get around that. Would have been hilarious if they censored out the F, so you say WW and then you blur out what the F stands for. Wild, wacky, fucking.
Oh, okay.
Would have been like unnecessary censorship.
I didn't get that, but yeah, nice.
So Crush and Ahmed start this one off. What did you think of the grappling here as Johnson swept him into a mount position and then Crush with a reversal on top?
I didn't notice it to that extent. It just looked like they were just piling on top of each other and rolling.
But. Not the smoothest ground games, okay. But nonetheless, a sweep from both men.
Yeah.
So very good here. I would have given them a stripe.
Sure.
Hey, I just realized I don't get my stripe doing no gi, do I? I got to do
gi.
You
do. No.
Oh, I can?
Yeah.
What do they put the stripe on?
Well, you have to bring your belt
for
testing. Well, you should get a belt.
Where do I get a belt? The bay?
No.
Where'd you get a belt?
I went and bought my gi.
I do have a belt somewhere.
Then find it.
I've got to find this missing gi of mine.
You know what? Just cut a piece of fabric, a white piece of fabric.
I went to my parents' house on the weekend and still couldn't find this gi.
You might have to buy a new one.
I was also hungover.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, good luck with that.
Yes. Number three was the fake Razor Ramon, and they were having technical problems that did not have the countdown clock. These were the flattest entrances, these first couple.
Oh, really?
Because you didn't even have music.
True.
Nor a countdown.
Yes, but the fake Razor received some boos, and
I hated it.
So.
Like, these are the lamest, two of the lamest gimmicks in WWF history.
Absolutely. But it's fun to just have them particularly appear in the middle of a Royal Rumble where you don't expect it. Completely, and all of a sudden, the Razor Ramon comes out, and it's, upon further inspection, not Razor Ramon.
In hindsight, to me, even if I was an aspiring wrestler and was offered this gimmick, and you think the chance of a lifetime to be on WWF television, I honestly think I would turn it down, because I feel this is the epitome of a short shelf life gimmick, and one that would be like the Scarlet Letter for the rest of my career. And it's interesting because Rick Titan is only remembered as the fake Razor Ramon, whereas fake Diesel, complete opposite.
Yeah. Well, one guy was a monster and the other was big, but couldn't work.
Needed a giant gimmick overhaul. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing that when you look at the history of Kane, two horrendous gimmicks that he overcame.
Yeah. Now, when they say Kane has more eliminations in the Rumble than anybody, do they count this run and his Isaac Yankum run as well?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I would not know the answer to that. I would assume no. Isaac Yankum ever in the Rumble?
I don't remember.
Because he would have been in the 96 Rumble. That would have been his time period. I don't know if he was in that Rumble or not.
I don't know if he had any eliminations in this either.
So anyway, Johnson just throws fake Ramon out right away, and the crowd boos him here. And then Johnson sees Farouk coming out, so Ahmed leaps over the top rope to the floor and chases after Farouk. Why Farouk was coming out, I have no clue. But if this was his plan...
Well, because Crush was there.
I guess.
To lure him out.
So anyway, Ahmed eliminates himself.
Yeah.
Not a bit of a trend in this Rumble.
Yes.
And speaking of which, still to come on this show, we're going to hear some brief comments from our good pal Jimmy Corderas, because there was some officiating questions coming out of this Rumble.
Yes.
Number four was Vinnius Godwin. Phineas?
Phineas.
Phineas.
Yeah.
Not Ooh. Vinnius.
I don't
Phineas.
Think so. Yeah, it's a PH.
Phineas.
Pig.
Austin was out fifth. Still no clock, but at least they got the music running here.
Yeah.
I assume fake Ramon came out to Razor's theme at the time, right?
I don't remember if he had his music at that time.
Were you watching at this time when they unveiled it? Because I remember this clear as day.
Oh, you mean if he normally had his music?
Yes.
Of course he did, yeah.
Yeah.
The whole package. Yeah.
Horrible gimmick. I always remember Jim Ross saying, next week, Razor Ramon and Diesel will be here on Raw.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So desperate at that time was this company. Godwin eliminates Crush. And then Austin.
It's so funny, though, just to see anybody try to impersonate Kevin Nash's mannerisms or Scott Hall's mannerisms. It's like Gilbert.
Have you heard Nash's story about
fake Diesel?
The fake Diesel?
No.
Again, this is Kevin Nash, and I always take what he says with a grain of salt, but he stated in an interview that on that Raw, Ross came out and said, next week, Diesel and Ramon will be here on Raw. And at the time, they hadn't signed whether it be a long-term deal with WCW or they were still finalizing something.
Okay.
And the WCW officials freaked out that Nash and Hall were going back, and they actually gave them more money
than they were originally offering.
Wow.
Because of that. Now, that story, it sounds a little too cute to be true for my liking, but if true, awesome.
Yeah.
Hilarious. Anyway, number six was Bart Gunn, who is sent into the ropes and then just sent out by Austin right away. And Austin here, doing the Mark Hominick, did some push-ups and then sat on the corner looking at the turnbuckle and checked his watch. So
Hominick didn't do that.
No, no. Hominick
did the push-ups.
Never looked at the watch.
No.
Anyway, Jake Roberts was the seventh one out, and they had, of course, had that feud in 96. Crowd came alive here, chanting for DDT. This was one of the few times during this Rumble that the crowd had a pulse.
Yeah, this whole time I felt nervous for Damian, because Damian was just sitting in a bag in the center of the ring. These guys, these giant men, were just fighting all around him. I thought they were going to stomp on him, and thank goodness one of the referees went to take him out.
Out next was the bizarre one, the British Bulldog. And during the entrance here, Roberts was eliminated. And then Ross lists the stats of the British Bulldog, saying that from the past two Rumbles. And then McMahon says, I think he was also the runner-up in 94. Which was not true. Vince McMahon fact-checking thread. Bulldog was not in the company in January of 94. Ninth out was Puroth, the luchador.
Who is that?
He was, I believe, working with AAA at the time.
Okay.
Puroth, who was one of Doc Hendricks' top 10 picks to win the Rumble. Is that the shittiest top 10 list you've ever heard of?
Yeah.
I want to see who his other picks were.
Well, when you're picking a top 10 out of 30.
Yeah, that's, here are my third, a third of the choices of who could win the Rumble.
Top 10.
Number 10 was the Sultan with the Iron Sheik. Ross notes it was his first Rumble, which technically not true, as this was the former Fatu and the future Rikishi Fatu. 11th was Mil Máscaras, making his one and only but very memorable Royal Rumble appearance. And hey, the crowd reacted well here to Mil, who was 55 years old at the time.
Would you say he's the biggest star amongst all the AAA people that attended?
Oh, on this show, absolutely. Absolutely. Of the Mexican stars, yeah, Mil Máscaras is certainly the biggest here. Triple H was out 12th, and Bulldog then eliminated the Sultan. 13th was Owen Hart, and they did the spot here where they were starting to tease dissension between the Bulldog and Owen, who were a tag team at the time, and Austin and a bunch of people, they were trying to eliminate Bulldog, and then Hart comes from behind and eliminates the Bulldog from behind him, and Bulldog calls Owen an idiot. And this is kind of a playoff the Diesel Michaels spot from 94, where Michaels came from behind and eliminated his partner.
And was Bulldog a babyface at this time?
No, he was still a heel, but they were certainly teasing like a breakup with Bulldog and Owen, which would continue on.
Okay.
And then they wouldn't break up, actually.
Because I'm just thinking back to that promo where he's like, you know, yelling at the crowd and then saying that he's bizarre, which is kind of a babyface thing to say, in my opinion.
Is it a babyface thing to say?
Yeah, I'm bizarre.
Okay.
Like me.
Like me. I'm crazy. Goldust was in 14th. Then Cibernetico, who, for whatever reason, I looked this up. Jim Ross said he is the youngest competitor here at 20 years of age, and I looked it up, and he was 21 at the time.
Wow. You really...
I get bored sometimes during these matches, and Wikipedia is just
really,
right there.
This whole fact-checking thread has really turned you into a fact-checking...
Yeah, I've become a...
Paranoid.
I've become a fact-checker myself.
All right.
Mark Merrow was number 16, and then Cibernetico is eliminated, and then Puroth is eliminated to the floor, to which Mil Máscaras climbs to the top rope and hits a crossbody to the floor, eliminating himself in one of the most famous eliminations in Rumble history.
This was bizarre.
Bizarre.
What happened?
I don't know what happened. You know what? At the end of the Rumble, we'll go to Jimmy, and he can expand more upon the Mil Máscaras elimination. But, you know, for his one and only, you know, he did do, like, some Madison Square Garden shows for the old WWWF. But for the modern era fan, this was his, like, lone impression on the WWF audience before going into the Hall of Fame last year. This is what people think of. The idiot who eliminated himself from the Rumble.
It seemed really strange because, you know, this guy, Mil Máscaras, jumps out of the ring, and then you can tell Jimmy and the other referee were just looking at each other as Mil Máscaras was climbing back into the ring, like, did we actually just see what we saw? And they were deciding, we can't let this go. We got to get this guy out of here. And that was that.
Yeah. Not a,
a very strange elimination. You know what was so weird on this was there was another sign in the crowd. Just the fact that Mil Máscaras, this is one show he is on, and there was a sign in the crowd that the bottom part was censored. So it had something to do with some copyright, probably a WWF reference or something. But it said, Del Rio loves, and then it had this blurring for whatever line it was. But how strange that the uncle of the future Alberto Del Rio, with a sign that read Del Rio in the crowd.
Maybe he was holding the sign.
Maybe it was, and he knew what name they would give him when he would sign in 2009.
Is Del Rio a place?
I don't know.
Or something?
Maybe. Maybe it is. I mean, it's just a weird coincidence.
Yeah.
Number 17 was the Latin Lover, who they explain used to be masked and now is unmasked, and they didn't really expand upon the fact that the male stripper gimmick.
Oh, right.
Which is a baby face in Mexico.
That is right.
So maybe Goldust could have got a stripping gimmick and realized you can be a stripper and a baby face.
Can you be a male stripper with a mask? Because you got to strip the mask. I mean...
Yeah, I don't know.
You're technically not completely naked if you're still wearing a mask.
Yeah. This could have been Kenny King's gimmick in TNA.
Hmm.
Almost, with the Chippendales background. Latin Lover comes into the ring, and he delivers a super kick to the ass of Goldust. Like, to the butt cheek.
Sweet ass music.
Drilled him in the ass.
Yeah.
Sweet ass music. Then they bring up Mark Mero and Sable apparently had an argument the night before on Shotgun Saturday Night, but they've patched things up. Rule of thumb in pro wrestling, when tag partners or couples have arguments, it's never patched up.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, Mark Mero tore his ACL, and they did patch things up for a longer period of time than expected. And then when he returned, things fell apart between Mark Mero and Sable.
Mm.
Owen sends Goldust to the floor and is eliminated. Farouk comes out 18th, and Latin Lover runs at him, and his back body dropped to the floor. Then there's a big brawl between Austin and Farouk, and Ahmed Johnson runs in with a giant 2x4. Why do they call this a 2x4? This looked like a 2x50.
I'm guessing 2x4 is the...
height and the width, maybe, and not the length.
Yes.
All right.
Or is that the height?
Well, the height would be... What would that... That would be height.
The width and the length.
And then that would be... That would be the width.
This would be the height. I don't know.
I haven't calculated area in a long time.
No.
Anyway. We're so stupid.
We do pro wrestling. Sorry.
This was a huge reaction when Ahmed ran in. This audience loved Attack via Wood.
Yes. You know, for all the shit we talk about Ahmed, I'd say he was over to
Oh, he was
to
over. There's no question.
Yeah.
I think I'm amazed that guy hasn't got a call for just a cameo over the years.
Have you seen the shape that he's in currently?
Well, yeah, we saw him at Wrestle Reunion.
We didn't know who that guy was.
Who's that big guy?
Yeah.
Ahmed Johnson?
Well, we didn't find out until much later.
Yeah. Big T.
Mm-hmm.
Big T.
Bigger T now.
I wonder now if that was a joke they made on him about, like, his testosterone levels. Big T. As opposed to low T.
I don't know. I don't know if people knew about testosterone levels at the time. Like,
in 2000?
Well, not in the way that we know it now. Like, that wasn't a buzzword at that time.
Maybe not. So anyway, Austin then eliminates Owen and Mark Mero together, and he's all alone once again in the ring. So Austin getting the Iron Man gimmick in the Rumble mm-hmm. and just destroying everyone.
As a heel.
Yes, yes. Savio Vega was then in 19th, and Vega takes him down with a double leg. They continue to fight, and it ends with Austin clotheslining him to the floor. 20th was Jesse James, pre-Road Dogg phase. This was when he was country singer Jesse James.
Double J Jesse James.
Yeah, Double J Jesse James, who lasted all of 30 seconds, was able to do his strut, and then was eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
21st, big pop here for Bret Hart, and Austin just sold this big when he puts his hands on his head, and he's all concerned. It's Bret Hart.
The greatest look. Yep.
Austin was great here. And Hart applies the sharpshooter onto him as the next entrant comes in. It's Jerry Lawler, who gets off his headset, comes in, is eliminated by one Hart punch, and sent to the floor, and he's eliminated in seconds, and then sells not remembering being in the Rumble for the rest of the match.
He leaves commentary in the middle of a sentence and comes back after
and
his
finishes
elimination.
His sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cute.
So funny. 23rd was the fake Diesel, Glenn Jacobs, coming out.
Who looks bigger than he does today.
Yes. Terry Funk was 24th, and he comes out, and they note how outspoken he was the night prior on Shotgun Saturday Night, to which Vince McMahon apologizes once again. And I've always heard this story, that he cut this promo on Shotgun Saturday Night, and it eventually did lead to his dismissal shortly thereafter.
Was that show live?
I think so. So I went online and found this promo, and this is what Terry Funk, well, presumably this led to his release from the company shortly after this event.
Uh-oh. There's not a person in the WWF that wants to rumble with me. Not a person in a WCW. Those bunch of snake sucking scumbags. They don't have an athlete enough for me. I'm looking around here. Where's Vince McMahon? That Yankee bastard. I realize this is lies. Hey, Pat,
I believe you can take him.
Give me the microphone. How about rumbling with you? Your mother's a whore.
Shut up, you bag of wind.
Why don't you rumble a little bit? Do you want to rumble, Ben Gale? No. No, you don't. Is there anybody here?
We're live, ladies and gentlemen.
Where are you,
from
Jim Ross?
Antonio Dick is in the ring.
Where
just
are you? You
legendary
asshole.
Terry Funk.
Oh, where are you?
And, again, where? It's a Shotgun Saturday night.
Oh,
and I think we apologize for some of those remarks, but Terry Funk has just fought a close call to Steve Austin.
He's wasting valuable airtime.
Yikes.
So, words not to give on a WWF broadcast. Whore, bastard, asshole.
Yeah.
But a great promo.
Great promo. Anyway. He would have fit in maybe 2 years later.
Oh, yeah. Well, he did come back a year later. Yeah. Chainsaw Charlie. True. Maybe that was Vince's
revenge. We got to bring this guy back.
You call me a Yankee bastard? Fuck you. Terry Funk here, he lifts up Bret Hart for a pile driver and just falls over.
Falls over. I didn't notice it.
Terry, like, stumbles here. It was not pretty. 25th was Rocky Maivia.
Mm-hmm. We got Rock versus Austin.
We got Rock and Austin in the Rumble. Actually, the last couple of guys here really adds up. We had Mankind come in 26th. So here we had Mick Foley, Bret Hart, Steve Austin, The Rock, Kane, and Terry Funk all in the ring together at once. Like, I would argue that of any six people in a Rumble at one time, pretty stacked here in this 97 Rumble of either past, present, or future stars.
Absolutely.
In this business.
Oh, all Hall of Famers, all of these guys. And maybe at one time.
With fake Diesel being the most unlikely future WWF champion.
Mm-hmm.
Flash Funk ended that streak, coming in number 27th, to thankfully Jim Ross alerting us, no relation to Terry.
Yes.
Thanks. That's great.
Although that would be a great sitcom. The Funks.
Terry and Flash Funk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vader was 28th.
Maybe they are related.
Maybe.
Somehow.
Maybe.
Yeah. You don't know.
Well.
You don't know.
Terry Funk explains that...
Dory Funk Sr. might have...
My mother was a whore! As he accused Pettengills of being. So Vader was 28th. Henry Godwin was 29th. And Vince, for whatever reason here, alerts us that Henry Godwin, the brains and the brawn of the Godwins... What a dig at Phineas.
Yeah.
The fuck is Phineas's role?
Obviously not.
Dead
neither.
Weight. Yeah. And number 30 was The Undertaker. And Vince, we always joke about Vince like getting ahead of himself on near falls. The winner of the 1997 Royal Rumble is on his way to the ring. What an objective journalist this fucker is.
Uh-huh.
Choke slams Austin and Vader. And then his first ever interaction with the future Kane.
Ah, that's right.
Maybe this was what would light the fire in this man.
Oh, okay.
Imagine they tried to take the backstory even further, that he was the fake Diesel and he was shunned by his brother who didn't recognize him when he came to the WWF.
Now, how would that figure into the whole cemetery burning and all that?
Well, he can say that when he torched his parents, he used diesel instead of regular gasoline, torched them. But yeah. He used some overseas diesel, which you could call fake diesel, to kill the parents.
Wow. You know what? You should call who wrote that book?
I think it was Mike Chiappetta.
He wrote that book.
I think it.
You got to call him in for a rewrite.
I don't think he would want to own up to that.
That works too well.
Kane book.
Oh, let's find God. This. That is
I seriously think he wrote Journey into Darkness. Is that it?
Mike Chiappetta, of course.
a novel by Michael Chiappetta and David Stern.
Oh, there you go. Mike Chiappetta, of course, who's now an MMA reporter.
At MMAfighting.com.
Renowned MMA journalist.
Oh, yeah, one of the best.
Respected MMA journalist. Also, on his resume, The Heart of Darkness.
Journey into Darkness.
Journey into Darkness.
Journey into Darkness.
Thinking of the Conrad novel, which he did.
Heart of Darkness. Yeah. The Unauthorized History of Kane. Now available in paperback. Oh, that's hilarious.
We got to review that.
We really should. That'll be our first book review.
Yeah.
So, Undertaker lifts Godwin, sends him out to the floor. Rocky Maivia jumps into the mandible claw and is eliminated by Mankind. And Mankind then vertical suplexes Flash Funk over the top to the floor from outside of the apron. Taker eliminates Mankind with a big boot. Austin then gets grabbed by Hart and is thrown over the top, but the referees are distracted with another elimination. So Austin sneaks back into the ring and dumps out the Undertaker, who is fighting with Vader, right as Hart eliminates the fake Diesel. And then Hart, thinking that he's won, turns around and Austin sends out Bret Hart to the floor, and Bret Hart just has this look of absolute shock.
Mm-hmm.
50 minutes, 34 seconds, Steve Austin wins his first Royal Rumble, but in very controversial fashion, Mr. Ting.
Yes, and you know, if I saw this at the time, I think I'd be really pissed. I mean, not just because I was a Bret fan, but because you're taking the Royal Rumble here and basically doing a
fucked finish
for something that, you know, goes down in the history books for a long time, the winner of the Royal Rumble. At the same time, though, you got to look at this and to see what came out of it. And I thought they did a tremendous job with both Steve Austin and Bret Hart here. Here you had Bret Hart complaining, and he had every right to complain. You know, he's a babyface, but whining to an extent that makes you dislike him. And Steve Austin, they gave him that great push in the middle, you know, basically taking everybody out. And the same time, you can tell they're subtly teasing a babyface turn, yet they never took his edge off of him. So often these days, you see when guys are turning babyface, they just all of a sudden start to, you know, cater towards the crowd, start smiling a lot. This Steve Austin babyface turn was nothing like that. He's still giving the finger to the crowd, still had all his attitude. Not fingering the crowd, but giving the finger to the crowd.
That's a heel move. All right.
A lot of work.
So, Bret Hart is pissed after the match, attacks the officials, and grabs poor Jimmy Corderas by the shirt.
And Jimmy was great, too.
Jimmy was
very
just awesome.
Funny, man. Looking scared and running away after Bret lets him go.
And then Bret grabs Vince and complains. Lawler wants Bret suspended for life, and Jim Ross calls this an emotional time for Bret, and the fans boo this finish. And obviously, the referee is front and center here. And let's hear from Jimmy Corderas, a brief little discussion of both Mil Moscris' elimination and the post-match here with Bret.
I want to ask you, one of my favorite all-time eliminations in Royal Rumble history, it came at the Alamo Dome with Mil Moscris, crossbody off the top to the floor. You were ringside to watch this. To me, one of the greatest eliminations in Rumble history.
Yeah, kind of eliminating yourself. And people have mentioned this to me where they said that Mil Moscris exited between the second and third rope, climbed up to the top turnbuckle, then dove out to the ringside area. The ruling at that time was, he actually established himself as being in the ring when he got to the top turnbuckle and then eliminated himself.
It was a rough night for you, Jimmy, with the Austin Bret Hart stumble there at the end. You had a bit of a Dan Mergliotta evening.
Yeah, a little bit of a hiccup there, but I paid the price for it. Bret had two handfuls of chest hair when he was roughing me up there.
He was not working light on you, Jimmy,
No.
Very, very convincing in that 1997 Royal Rumble.
So there you go, Jimmy Corderas giving his thoughts on the Mil Moscris elimination and then this post-match. So the crowd furious at this finish, and to me,
you know, in hindsight, this really did play out. There was a reason behind this, of Brett constantly feeling he's been screwed out of these opportunities. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I really liked it, because this really built up that justification for Brett's change in character. But you wouldn't have wanted to end the show with this. So it totally made sense to put the Michaels, the big title win on last, and this second from the top.
Mm-hmm. I just thought, especially for 97, on the same show where you get a gimmick like a fake Diesel or a fake Razor, you had a very well done and very believable babyface and heel in transition in both Brett and Austin.
This was laid out really well. Right. Everything with Austin and Brett at this time was really laid out very, very well. And that was one thing with the Rumble, was that it was enough of a like, you understood why Brett was furious. I mean, this guy got fucked out of the Rumble win. We all saw him win, and
yet at the same time, the way he complains about it and the way you know, just the behavior afterwards is certainly unhero-like.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you know, in a MMA fight, when afterwards a guy will then list off all his injuries or complain about a late early stoppage and stuff, where it's it'll rub people the wrong way, even if the guy might have a point.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was the finish to the Rumble. Not one of the better Royal Rumbles, I find, in history. You know, you had a lot of names that were on the rise at that point and didn't really hit their character peaks till a little bit after that, Austin included. But the likes of the Rocky Maivia and Mankind and where they were eventually going. So then we go to the main event, and they air a video on Sid and Michaels with their differing bad attitudes. And this featured an angle on television where Sid powerbombed Jose Lothario's son, Pete.
Yes.
Pete Lothario. And they featured an interview afterwards with Jim Ross speaking to Shawn Michaels on Superstars from earlier that morning. And he's going into this match battling the flu. And he said, "I will be ready and I will be better than Sid tonight and I will be champion."
Didn't look like he had the flu.
He looked kind of shitty.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit of a cough, maybe the influenza going around.
Mm.
They show Shawn Michaels.
They spent a lot of time in that bear hug. So I worry about Sid. Probably spreading.
I wrote this early on, that Shawn Michaels was locking up and maybe trying to pass on his virus to Sid.
There's some
wear him out over an hour. Sean's got the better cardio, and Sid starting his immune system would shut down.
I think it takes at least a day that to
doesn't
to spread, doesn't it?
Well, it's this is instant. Wrestling creative license,
right?
Great psychology.
Okay, he beats him via flu.
Yes. They gave the whole big match feel to this, with Michaels in the back walking towards the entrance with Jose Lothario wearing a cowboy hat and Texas tights.
Mm-hmm.
So not being subtle at all. Cheer me, I'm from your town. And Psycho Sid, Shawn Michaels come out for the WWF title, and Sid gets knocked to the floor early on, and they show Pete in the crowd wearing a cowboy hat, and Lawler points out that he couldn't even get front row tickets.
He probably only wanted to spend $17.
Yeah. He's on a budget.
Yeah.
There's an Irish whip to the corner that sends Michaels to the floor, and then Michaels gets rammed into the steel post on the floor, and Sid gets a two count here. Crowd just hating Sid and loved Shawn Michaels. Mm-hmm. So a big role reversal from their match at the Survivor Series. And Sid, I thought Sid was great here. He's taunting the crowd as they boo him, just trying to elicit a real negative response and continued his beatdown of Michaels. Michaels stops him eventually with an inverted atomic drop and then jumps off the turnbuckle into my favorite wear down hold, the bear hug. Michaels escapes, hits a scoop slam as the crowd is cheering, and then a flying forearm and kip up before he hits a top rope elbow drop. But Sid blocks the sweet chin music, back body drops Michaels to the floor, and then powerbombs Shawn onto the floor, and then grabs Jose and Pete by the throat. He's going to kill father and son here, but Michaels gets up, he lets go of both men by the throat, and Michaels then gets sent into the corner, but the referee gets knocked out as Michaels is thrown into him. As Earl Hebner goes out, Michaels takes a choke slam, but as I said, the referee's out. Another referee runs in, and Michaels kicks out, and Sid attacks the second official. How is this not a DQ?
Well, if you attack the ref, he's knocked out.
Is the secondary referee not allowed? He can end a match via his count, but cannot call for a disqualification?
He knocked the ref out, did he not? So yeah,
I guess, but he's got to come to at some point.
Well, it'll be too late by then.
I don't know about that. This seemed questionable.
Well, the ref didn't come to.
The officiating on this card left a little to be desired.
Sure.
Jose then gets onto the apron, and Sid goes, and they tease that he's going to attack Jose just like he did at the Survivor Series. But this time, Shawn Michaels grabs a video camera and hits Sid from behind right into the chest. Crowd pops, and Hebner comes to, goes for the count, and Sid kicks out at two. Big pop there. But then Michaels gets to his feet, hits the sweet chin music, and pins Sid 13 minutes and 50 seconds in one of Sid's better matches of his entire career. And Michaels then celebrates with Jose Lothario, and Vince McMahon proclaims, "This is what pay-per-view is all about." Another dig. And they show Shawn Michaels' parents sitting at ringside. They got front row seats. He hugs them. He goes by a fan who's got a sign that reads, "Shawn, keep your pants on." And he gets onto the announce table, shakes his ass into Vince McMahon's face.
Yeah.
These two had a strange relationship. There's that spot where he kisses Vince right on the lips. And again, nothing wrong with that. But they had an odd relationship.
He's just really happy. Thank you for giving me this moment.
I don't recall you ever celebrating by, you know, shaking your ass into one of our senior producers' face.
I'm not a...
A dancer?
I'm not a heartbreak kid.
No, you're not.
I'm not a showstopper.
I thought the boy grew up. He was a man now.
A heartbreak man?
Okay. Anyway, Lawler just says, "I am sick of this hug fest." And Michael celebrates, including high-fiving with Vladimir the Superfan, which is great. Front row. Made the trip to San Antonio.
Paid $175.
Yeah, he really did.
Yep.
And then the show ends with a recap video of the event. What did you think of this main event?
I thought
it was the best match on the show.
Yes, I agree with you there, but I didn't think
not
it was
enough
that great
for
either.
A 1 out of 6.
No, I really felt this was far from memorable in terms of match quality. But you know, a great moment for this crowd, great moment for Shawn Michaels. But I basically don't count it as I don't know, even top 15 of Shawn Michaels' moments.
Oh, I wouldn't say this was, you know, one of Shawn Michaels' best matches, but I also consider the opponent here being Sid.
Okay.
So in that regard, I thought this match was a fine main event. Crowd went home happy with Shawn getting the big title win.
Was that the very reason for Sid to even have the title for that very brief run?
I think the plan all along was, you know, have a big match for San Antonio, and Shawn Michaels challenging is a lot better hook than Shawn Michaels defending.
There
so I think that was probably Sid knew he was dropping that title the minute he won that title in November. And Shawn would hold that title for all of 4 weeks before losing it via in-ring interview with his knee injury.
So was Bretton Shawn the plan even at this point?
Yes. At this point, it was supposed to be Michaels Bret at Mania.
Then at what point were they going to do Austin and Bret?
That wasn't the plan. They had done the match.
But they certainly put the
I think maybe I don't know, you know, concrete what plans were. They still had that February pay-per-view where they could have done a rematch.
Okay.
Where if I was booking this, and I don't know if this was the plan or not, but just the way I would have done it was that if Bret was beating Shawn at Mania, I would have had Austin beat Bret at the February show, and then you set up a program for Bret post-WrestleMania with the guy who beat him the month prior, which they did 1 year with Austin and Triple H in 2001.
But Bret lost the Rumble. So Austin had that title shot lined up. And how did they get around that?
Oh, you know what? They probably would have done the rematch, and Bret would beat Austin for that title shot, would think.
Okay.
They'd have to do that,
now,
wouldn't they?
How did they even get around Austin winning the Rumble after this?
Well, the way they set it up was that, you know what? They must have announced that the final, because the next February show, they did a final four with the final four guys in the Rumble, which were Vader, Taker, Bret, Austin. The winner of that was originally to get the title shot. So that was the way that Bret could have won without beating Austin.
Okay.
And then when Michaels, that injury came out of nowhere, then they announced the winner gets the title.
Somehow
that's how they set it up.
And somehow they ended up with Sid versus Taker.
That's how they ended up with probably the worst option of all those combinations.
Yep.
Not the match people remember WrestleMania 13 for. But, you know, in a weird way, everything worked out. But it's amazing how you think about it. Had
Shawn not lost his smile and had to put over Bret at WrestleMania, it's interesting to think what would have happened after
that.
Yeah,
you wouldn't
Survivor Series probably wouldn't have been necessary.
Perhaps.
They probably would have wanted to do the third match at some point.
You also wouldn't have had Bret versus Austin at Mania. I mean, you would have had it down the line somewhere.
A lot of different things could have gone on. Very interesting to play the what-if game at this point in time in history. So that was the Rumble. I didn't think a great show. I'm going to give this one a 2 out of 10. Yeah. And if you're upset at that rating, I think you're just too nostalgic for an old show.
Yeah, and you know what? I give this maybe a 2, 2.5 simply because of nostalgia and because I do enjoy the Rumble simply for the match type itself. It's always fun to see, especially looking back on these shows, all these old characters come in, unannounced. I always think that's a spectacle. So that's my vote.
All right. So we teased this on Review a Raw. Before we get to the feedback, Way, do want to remind people that you still have a few days to enter our Royal Rumble pool, which is coming up. Deadline is this Saturday, noon Eastern time, and the announcement is up at lawradio.proboards.com. All you need is a free account on our message board, and you can enter. You send me a private message with your picks, and they are as listed in that announcement. Who draws number one? Who draws number 30? Who lasts the longest? Bunch of different categories. And we're going to be giving out a number of prizes, including, Way, a mystery package that Chris Engler sent to us saying that we could give away for the Rumble pool. Now, this is sealed, Way.
What's in it?
I don't know. So I'm going to open it right now.
All right. Wow.
And this is one of the prizes.
An exclusive.
Okay. We just received this right before the show today, today being Wednesday. So let's see what Chris Engler has so kindly donated to us to give away.
All right.
Oh, my goodness.
Uh-oh.
There are comic books. Okay, I'm going to read these first. We have issue number one of the Mankind comic book from September of 1999 and issue number one, probably of one, of the China comic book from September of 2000.
Oh, my God.
Dear John, please find and close the China and Mankind comics from the late 90s. I thought with all the talk of comics lately on your review podcast, this may be a fun diversion from a wrestling pay-per-view for a review away episode. Seeing as these are fetching for less than $1 on eBay these days, I'm not concerned about getting these back. Take care and thank you for the great podcast. Look at that. A printed out letter from Chris Engler.
Hey, thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you to Chris. Always been a longtime supporter of our shows and was actually the man who designed our Excel sheet for these complicated Rumble pools. So a big thank you to Chris Engler. So those are two prizes amongst the many prizes we'll be giving out for some of the Royal Rumble pool winners.
I don't know if I want to give that away.
Well, I want to definitely read this China one because, boy, Way, I'm going to leave these with you, Way. So,
well, you will each read one and then we'll switch, okay? How about that?
Let's be honest. We both want to read the China one.
Yeah.
And probably neither of us are going to read the Mankind
one. I'll read the Mankind one.
Yeah? Mankind, I...
Let me see that.
Very embellished arms. I like how Mankind is animated, and China, they just went with an action shot.
Well, how could you recapture the image of China in drawing?
I guess a real photo of Mankind at this point in time was not the most intimidating sell. It's a very exaggerated Mick Foley here. He looks like, look at him, he's slobbering from the mouth. He's got like...
Well, this is bad radio. We'll show it to you.
Terrible.
And you know what? If you win this, you'll get to see it for yourself.
So we're going to list a number of winners this Monday on Review a Raw, and the winners will get prize packs. So we'll have some DVDs in there, some books, and yes, some comics.
One of you, or maybe two of you, will get some comics.
Yep. Maybe a visit by Wei Ting himself. Maybe after work he can drive by some winner's house.
I'm not doing that.
No? Okay.
Why would I do that?
I don't know. You're a social person. You like talking.
Wait, I don't want to deliver. I'm not your delivery boy. That's what you're insinuating.
You're delivering yourself. A conversation with Wei Ting.
Okay, maybe you could do it.
No one wants to meet me at all. All right, let's head on over to the message board and see what you guys had to say about the 97 Rumble from the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, Texas. We start off with Bosch from the NYC. I didn't mind this week's swerve because I prefer this over 2008, although I'd still like 95. But I really enjoyed this Rumble. Being a huge HBK mark growing up, I was really excited to see him get retribution over Sid for his loss at Survivor Series, especially in his hometown. Austin really became a star in this match, and it's when I really became a fan of his. Every time he would eliminate a superstar and look at his wrist waiting for the next guy to come out was awesome, and you knew it would finally lead to Bret entering the Rumble. Despite the controversy after this match, and with the constant dropping of titles into Mania, it was a pretty good show. One issue I do have is, the following month there was a Final Four for the title featuring Vader, Austin, Bret, and Taker, but the fake Diesel was eliminated after Vader, so technically he should have been in the Final Four. Remember 95. Now to this, they actually explained this on television and sewed up the logic gap, because Vader and Taker were eliminated illegally by Austin, who re-entered, whereas fake Diesel was eliminated by Bret, who was still a legal participant in the Rumble, and therefore didn't have a claim to still be in a match. He was eliminated by the legal man in Bret Hart.
Well, it's some fine attention to detail.
Very much so, you know.
Although we could have had Sid versus fake Diesel.
Oh, what could have been?
Yeah, the main event of WrestleMania 13.
Wow.
We got a Christian Small who says, this was one of the first VHSs I ever got, and I watched it over and over. The look of this Rumble in the show was amazing because they were in such a big arena, and it was almost full, although it would be cool to see how it looks nearly empty, but lockdown will show us that. Is it the same arena? The same stadium?
It is the same, but it's been configured for like 8,000, so right. It's going to be extremely tarped off, so it's not going to look terrible.
The show itself was all right when I look back. Nothing really stands out besides the main event and the Rumble. I personally really liked the Rumble match as it had so many future stars in it, so it was fun to watch and think what each person would become. Also, the Austin winning story throughout was great, and you had to love Jerry Lawler's It Takes a King to Know a King elimination. As for the main event, it was good, and Shawn could get good out of anybody, but it fell flat to me somewhat. I don't know, Shawn just didn't seem into it, and you think he would since the show pretty much revolved around him. But did you guys know that this was originally meant to be Vader in Sid's role? The original plan was for the two to work SummerSlam, which they did, with Shawn barely winning, Vader beating Shawn for the title at Survivor Series, and then Shawn beating Vader at the Rumble. Knowing that, it makes a lot more sense that they aimed for a big arena, as the Sid program was majorly rushed. Now let the threats for swerving begin slash continue. Personally, I find it funny that you swerved us twice, although I would have liked that you go over to the 95 Rumble, but I'm not getting into that.
What controversy has been caused by these swerves, Way?
Well, as long as people are talking, right?
That's always the defense of making shitty decisions and booking. Nick Q from Burlington. Before I give my feedback, I just want to congratulate John on the MMA report. I finally got to check out the podcast, and it's quite a great show. Well, thank you very much, Nick. I appreciate it. I just got into watching wrestling at this time. I was 8 years old. Rumble 97 is one of many WWF pay-per-views my brother got to see at a friend's house, and I was forced to watch via Scramble Vision. That just sounds so sad.
We've all
older brother
it.
Telling him, I'm going to watch the Rumble at my friend's house. Have fun. It featured the short-lived return of Mr. Hughes. I was a huge mark for The Undertaker at this time, and I was remembering being pissed that he lost to Vader. 97 Rumble continued the slow rise of Austin and his feud with Bret Hart. Austin's facial expression when Bret drew number 21 was great. Austin and Bret brawling showcased what was to come at Mania 13. Michaels captured the title back from Sid, but soon dropping it to him on Thursday, Raw Thursday. I don't think I really need to get into Shawn losing his smile, so I'll finish it up here. All in all, a 6 out of 10.
Excuse me.
Certainly a future review. Thursday, Raw Thursday.
Thursday, Raw
the
Thursday.
The best titled event in history.
Bhavin Patel from New Jersey. I'm so pissed off that you guys pushed back the 2008 Rumble till next week.
Assholes.
We didn't say that.
Oh, yeah, we didn't push it back. Yeah, guys, we were never going
might
to
not do it.
Come on.
Might not do it at all. Now, don't get me wrong. I like the pick, but 2008 was... That one has history for me, being that it was the last ever WWE pay-per-view I ever purchased legally.
Oh, what a milestone.
Oh, yeah. Wow, we should go back and really do that one. Well, anyway, I've seen this Rumble when it came out in the WWE anthology set a couple years ago, so I'll go off the top of my head from what I remember. I can't believe the Sid versus... This has got to be the laziest piece of feedback ever. You don't buy pay-per-views. And you're also not even going to look back on the show
come
before
on,
you
guys,
make your feedback.
Come on, we do rank effort here.
I'll read through it anyway. Michaels versus Sid match was last. I can't believe that. Nowadays, we get pissy when the Rumble isn't last, but I think this is the first time it wasn't last. From what I remember, this match was great. I love Sid's entrance. The Rumble itself was, well, like the talent pool right now, very thin on over guys. I also liked how Austin won, even though he got cheated at the next pay-per-view.
You know what a weird stat is for our reviews the last 2 weeks, Way?
What's
is that?
That
last week we reviewed the Rumble from Miami in 91, coming off of SmackDown in Miami, where The Rock was on. Mm. And this week I noticed that we were reviewing the Rumble from San Antonio and last week SmackDown in San Antonio.
Wow.
So this week, SmackDown's in Sacramento.
I'm impressed you know all this off the top of your head.
Way. I don't have a life. And you're aware of that. You're the well-rounded one. And I remember dates. Okay, we go to Alexander Rios from Miami. I think back of 97 in WWF is a year that is pretty much historic for many reasons, most of them obvious. March 97 as the beginning of Raw as War in the Attitude Era. Hell in the Cell, Survivor Series, the advancement of guys like Austin and Rock. That being said, the beginning of 97 still had that 94 to 96 stink all over it. The Royal Rumble, I have to think of it as the event as just that Triple H versus Goldust was whatever. Nothing memorable, despite the fact that I still remember this match. Goldust was losing his 95-96 heat, and Triple H was still getting punished for the curtain call. And at this time, and a long time after, he was that wrestler that always needed a manager. Vader fought the Undertaker with Paul Bearer at Vader's side. Wasn't Bearer still attached to Mankind by this point? Austin winning the Rumble, only to face Bret in a double turn match. 4 out of 10.
John, from Parts Unknown. The biggest standout from this Rumble is the Crap Fest hosted by the token luchadors right in the middle of the event. I think I heard someone burp from the second row. While Garza was killing himself all over the place, Vince tried his best to sound impressed by the action, and Jim Ross added some boring context. Everything and everyone felt out of place in this match, especially the fat referee rocking a purple headband. You could tell that everyone regretted this booking decision. I remember renting the event with a friend after we discovered the awesomeness of Raw in late 97. We both marveled at how badass Austin was, throwing everyone out with relative ease. Austin sitting on the turnbuckle while looking at his absent watch has always been my favorite Stone Cold moment, and I don't get why it never shows up in his highlight reels. It's also a cool foreshadowing to his post-WrestleMania X7 heel turn.
We go on over to Andrew McDonald. I feel the non-Rumble matches, while they had great wrestlers in them, came off as a bit boring thanks to the dead crowd, even though WWE seemed to want to go a little more violent, with the referees letting a lot go. A couple of things I noticed about the Rumble, though. The fake Razor Ramon was awful. He was in the ring with Ahmed, and Ahmed was the much better worker. It was astounding. Quite the contrast to his partner, the fake Diesel. It's maybe the only time where the blatant ripoff was better than the original. I also found that this Royal Rumble was one of the first to be very well structured. Austin's babyface turn was months away, but looking back watching this, WWE did a great job at getting the fans to cheer for Austin by being a complete badass and sticking around the ring by himself. He was also very sympathetic when he was alone in the ring, breathing heavy and struggling to get up. And while Austin took the cheap way out to win the Rumble, Bret Hart didn't endear himself by freaking out on Jimmy Corderas and Vince McMahon. The non-Rumble matches were okay, but this was one of my favorite Rumble matches. 7 bizarre Bulldog promos out of 10. Very nice.
We go to Paulette, who actually this past week wrote a really nice write-up about our podcast, along with some other ones you should check out. So go visit his blog, which I can't really tell you what it is right now. But
BigBlueCage.wordpress.com.
There you go.
Very nice write-up on us and our good pals at MLW and The Art of Wrestling
calling us a couple of sarcastic dicks.
Who grow on you.
Yes.
So that's nice.
Ah. No pun intended. Paul Elliott, who says, I'll echo what Jim Cornette said about this show on a Shoot interview, that it was a stadium that needed a show rather than a show that needed a stadium. It just seems really odd to have such a huge venue for a show 3 months before WrestleMania, which would be held in the relatively small Rosemont Horizon in Chicago. Was there a reason for using such a large venue like a stadium other than it being a major pay-per-view?
I don't know what the decision process was. My guess would be, and the fact that lockdown is coming at this place, I would guess the rent at Alamo Dome is not through the roof.
Perhaps.
Pardon the pun. And you know what? They still got, you know, they priced it accordingly to where they got a decent gate, and it looked good on television.
Impressive. And something you can brag
certain
about.
The show didn't lose money, so yeah. What not?
He goes on to say, there are two reasons I was looking forward to this review. The one good, one bad. The good, Austin's response to Bret's entrance at the Rumble, perfectly pitched, in that, like any good heel when confronted, Austin instantly freaks but then pulls himself together to still look like a credible threat. The bad, I actually came across the Luchas match a few months ago while surfing YouTube in the early hours that put me off to sleep. I remember thinking I had reached delirium and having to go back to certain spots because I could not believe how much was either botched or walked through on a live pay-per-view. I didn't know so many people in the venue could make so little noise either watching this. Truly a misfire in every sense. I would love to have had a camera on Vince's face while he was calling the match just to see a man four-stop a stroke.
We go on over to John from Hamilton. First time I've ever watched this Rumble, but seeing as it's part of my collection, I thought I'd check it out for the review. This has got to be the worst Rumble card I've seen to date. This show really seemed to drag, though the undercard matches had some decent stories behind them. There was nothing really special about any of them. The Lucha Botch Fest was fun, but felt 30 minutes long for some reason. You could really tell this was a period where WWF was starting to take a different direction with more mature content. The Rumble was nothing special outside of Austin in the last 15 to 20 minutes once Bret got in. However, even the worst Rumbles are passable matches. The main event between Michaels and Sid was the most alive the crowd felt all night. It seems like they finally woke up for the last 90 minutes of the show. Well, in fairness, that's half the card. I'm a Sid mark and enjoyed the match for what it was. Nowhere near the Survivor Series match, but still good. One thing I never understood was how Austin won, but never ended up wrestling for the belt at Mania. What was the politics behind that for Lucha Botch Fest out of 10? Well, he was never earmarked for that. It progressed the Bret Austin story, and at the same time, Austin and Bret were really the highlights of this Rumble, and they were also booking something for the February pay-per-view.
Mark from Calgary, I hadn't seen this since whenever I rented it from the video store as a kid, but I found it and decided to check it out. The opener with Gold Dust and Triple H was really long and really slow. I had no idea that Curtis Hughes was a former manager of the future King of Kings. He was Jericho's manager for a cup of coffee during 99, so apparently that was just his gimmick or something. Crush and the White Rapper seemed so out of place in the Nation, considering the whole Black Power deal of the gimmick. I don't think they were part of it for very long. The Lucha match seemed so bizarre to see on a WWF pay-per-view. Vince kind of sounded like he had his hands full on commentary for that match. The Rumble match itself was one that stuck around in my memory because of Austin's amazing performance. I always liked the ending with Austin cheating to win, though the Mania main event changed about 1,000 times due to the constant title changes following Shawn losing his smile after winning the main event.
Aram Nasrallah. Hey guys, I'll be listening to the show while I'm preparing for my tournament match at the 2013 BJJ Euros. I love this pay-per-view. Austin's facials when Bret enters, Owen and Bulldog spot, Vader's surprise win, and especially Ahmed Johnson. In the lead-up to the match, he yelled, Jub Gabba Do or something at Farouk. What the hell was that? Only question there is now is how is TNA going to fill this arena? 8 Ahmed Johnsons out of 10. Well, TNA scaling this much smaller.
What could that mean? Jub Gabba Do.
Jub Gabba Do.
I don't know. Eddie from Owen Sound. I love the show, guys. These podcasts always keep me entertained during my night shifts at work. I like this Rumble. The Sid versus HBK match was good and probably one of the best matches of Sid's career. I wasn't big on the Taker versus Vader match and was a little shocked when Vader got the win. The Rumble match itself was great, but I remember at the time not liking the finish since I was hoping for a Bret versus Shawn rematch. Of course, we all know how that went. Anyway, a decent show, 6 out of 10. Also, for your next Rumble, would you please review the 2003 Rumble as it's one of my favorites? For having one of the best matches I've ever seen and one of the worst matches in existence.
Jamie from Ottawa writes, this was an okay show as I watched it many times back in the day. I enjoyed the Lucha talent that they brought in, even Mil Máscaras, who had to be pushing 60 at the very least. Terry Funk was a nice surprise in the Rumble. Funny comment from Waller was, is Terry Funk related to Flash Funk? Sid and Shawn was pretty much as expected. Nothing else really big other than the Austin watch moment, which was mildly hilarious. But more hilarious was Austin's reaction to Bret Hart's entrance. 5.5 out of 10. Seems that Austin's reaction to Bret was everyone's highlight on this show.
Oh, yeah. Spud Bergman from Montpelier, Idaho, Space Sector 2814.
There's no way that guy is from Idaho.
I like the idea of the WWE allowing 3 to 5 local independent/territory wrestlers to be in the Rumble, and I'd like to see them do this every year. I really enjoyed the finish having Austin win the way he did, and to me it makes perfect sense for the referees to get distracted and not see someone get thrown out. It was original and better yet has never been duplicated. Mr. Hughes should serve as a warning. If you steal the Undertaker's urn, you will be banished from the WWE for 4 years and will only be allowed to return briefly as a mid-card bodyguard. Lastly, seeing Crush enter first made me reflect on this character's career and how often it changed. None of the modifications were ever a huge success, but were never an epic fail either. My favorite version was always the one that was paired with Yokozuna. I'm curious which versions were your favorite. Demolition, Kona, Crush, Yokozuna Sidekick, Nation, or DOA? And you got to throw in, what is it, Chronic in there as well.
Yeah, he was Chronic Crush. He was NWO Crush, right. Or NWO Bryan Adams, I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah. Oh,
geez. I gotta go with Kona Crush.
Yeah, me too. I always loved the vignettes where he just crushed shit, and they showed him as a child, like crushing pop cans. Great stuff. Trent from Texas. This show marks the landmark debut of Jamie Dundy on Review Away. For anybody that doesn't know him, do yourself a favor and look him up and listen to some of the interviews he's done or some of the many appearances he had on the Jerry Springer Show. He's in the pantheon of great shoot interviewers and possibly the worst ambassador for pro wrestling. Also, despite it being in San Antonio, the stars were out in the audience that night. Shawn Michaels' parents were sitting front row to the hard camera, some country singer that Pettengill had to pretend anybody knew, and the epic pairing in the front row of East Coast mega fans Vladimir and Faith No More guy. This was the wrestling fan equivalent of the Mega Powers teaming up, and he's got a photo of these two together. but that said, I have seen these two together at lots of shows in the past. In fact, if you go back to some of the WrestleManias, these guys are pretty much... They're at a lot of shows together. They've got to know one
another.
They've
got to be friends.
Yeah, look how close they're sitting together, no less.
Oh, both of them hugging Michaels, too.
My biggest regret from WrestleMania weekend last year, not talking of Vladimir. Yeah. It was amazing at the time that they had no Latino wrestlers other than Savio Vega on the roster, and they had to get second-rate AAA wrestlers to help. I find it amazing that despite making up 13% of the population and having a Spanish-language announce team, that they didn't even try to cater to that market by having Latino wrestlers. I think a lot of it was no Mexican wrestlers having the size or look that McMahon wanted at that time. Conan spoke about this on his podcast, that their big shows and Canes are only like 6'4 at most, and you'll be hard-pressed to find any wrestler over 300 pounds. Still, I find it amazing that only in the last 5 years that they've really gone out of their way to get wrestlers of Mexican descent to cater to that market. I felt that having this in the Alamo Dome diluted having shows in stadiums. There was no energy at all, and nothing was made of filling out a 60,000 seat stadium. It barely even came off as being big league, despite there being more than 60,000 fans. I would go so far as to say if they had this in the ECW arena, it might have been come off better, despite 59,000 less fans. Mediocre show at best, 5 out of 10.
Finally, from David Doofenberg, the King of the Ring has the promo that really put Austin on the map, but to me this Royal Rumble performance is what solidified his place at the top. He played such a great heel throughout the match that you couldn't help but notice he had that something extra needed to be a top player in the business. At the time, though, I remember being so mad that Austin won the Rumble by cheating. How dare he screw Bret Hart out of winning the Rumble? It was played off well and was the perfect way for the heel to win it. It also set up for an amazing match the next month to get the title situation handled leading into WrestleMania. Shawn versus Sid wasn't too much to write home about, but my god, the crowd was retarded for HBK. It's those hometown moments you love to see, and it came across really well. I've watched that Rumble match and world title match back to back numerous times, and it never gets old to me. I give it an 8 out of 10, which is fairly generous considering I enjoy ring work a whole lot, but the stories and characters really sold the show for me, and the Rumble and the main event.
All right. Well, that is all of your feedback, so thank you very much. And you can always leave feedback at lawradio.proboards.com. We post our feedback threads up every single week for Raw, Impact, and whatever pay-per-view or event we choose to review on Review Away. So that's going to bring us to the end of the program. And once again, you can go join the Royal Rumble pool. It's up until Saturday at noon in preparation for the Rumble this Sunday. Go to lawradio.proboards.com. Next week, Mr. Ting, it is the final Review Away for the month of January this year. Mm-hmm. What direction shall we go in for next week? And we should stick to this direction.
Okay. You know what? Let's for the man that was disappointed we didn't do the 2008 Rumble. Let's do the 2008 Rumble. especially since next week it will have been 5 years since the event date.
5 years.
Yeah, it took place on the 28th or 27th, right?
Perfect. So we will do that. 2008 Royal Rumble from Madison Square Garden. That is coming up for real. We are going to do this next week. No, we are. I don't want Bobbin to hate us. Yeah. So just for you, we are doing the 2008 Royal Rumble, which may have a tie-in with John Cena winning the Rumble on that event and this Sunday.
Maybe.
All right. So me and Wei are going to go out. Wei's going to get some poutine, and then we're going to go over to Schwartz
right now.
Are you excited?
Actually, we're here already. We've been recording this whole thing. Yeah.
Amazing. All right, so that is all for us this week. Once again, you can go to liveaudiowrestling.com. Join the Law message board at Wei0937 at Law Radio. We will be back this week with plenty more shows. And then this coming Sunday, Wei Ting is going to sit down and watch a pay-per-view.
Yes, I am.
This is one of your shows to watch for this entire year.
Yeah, I only have a few within me. But the Rumble, come on. How could you miss the Rumble?
All right. So there you go, everyone. We could have gone in the direction and done a Rumble from Sacramento, which there is one that exists.
Is there?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's consider it. Why don't you write it down on a piece of paper and we'll choose.
Nah, let's do 2008.
All right.
Let's do it 2008. All right. That's all for us, everyone. Music to go out with. I think only appropriate that let's hear some Faith No More to end this big, the mega powers of pro wrestling fans coming together. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We will chat with you later this week.
Faith No More guy.